dear friends of Dallas, of Texas, and of this great Southwest land, it is with an emotion quite indescribable that I bring you greetings and congratulations from your brother and sister AAs everywhere. And everywhere for AA is now a lot of territory. For we can be found from Scandinavia to South Africa. Meetings are going on from Alaska to Australia. Tonight, AAs look up at the Southern Cross, and they look up at the North Star. I wish every one of them could share the love and the hospitality which is radiated out to me and to all us Outlanders from you of Dallas and this marvelous state of the Lone Star. On behalf of us all who are your visitors, I thank you from the bottom of my heart. For 15 years now, you and I have been watching a great building under construction. To us, it is much more than a building. It is a temple. It is a cathedral of the spirit, into which well over 100,000 of us have already entered, and therein have found a peace and a freedom that in other days we never could have dreamed. Tonight, we shall see that we are approaching the completion, in a structural sense, of our cathedral, although let us hope that its great floor expands to accommodate the million yet to come, and that its traditional side walls contain us all in unity for so long as God shall want it. So now I think I would like to take each of you by the hand and lead you back to the days of our beginning, and with you enter that first dim trail, which during our infancy widened out into a path trod by a few, and finally into this broad highway, which men call Alcoholics Anonymous. And as we pass along that course, I would like to indicate to you those great hours of realization that we have taken together, and those great hours of decision that have so deeply affected the destiny of this society. And that will bring us to where we now stand together tonight. And then you and I will try to lift the veil of the future a little to see what that might hold for this beloved fellowship. When you stop to think about it, AA has been a series of realizations and discoveries and decisions which we have all shared. My mind goes back to the first one that I had, which had an important bearing on this society to come. It was the day I lay in a drying out place in summer of 1934. And for the first time, I knew that I was utterly hopeless, that I was possessed of a devilish obsession which condemned me to drink against my will, and an increasing bodily sensitivity that assured that I would go mad or die. Indeed, I was in the grip of a greater power, and he was John Barleycorn. Well, you see, that realization of hopelessness later turned out to be the very cornerstone of our AA program, You read it in that first step. Our lives became unmanageable. And such was my case in the summer of 1934. But I did not share this realization alone, happily. I had a partner in it. I speak of Lois, my wife. I just spoke with her on the phone. She sends you all her great love. Well, in that very hour of my own darkness, she had her own. Because she was sitting downstairs with a certain Dr. Silkworth, later himself, to play an important part in the destiny of this society. And that saintly old gentleman was telling her of my condition. And like many another wife before and since, she was asking the eternal question, why can't he get well? He has wanted to for years. Why doesn't his willpower work anymore? Oh, tell me, doctor, why is all this? And, of course, the good man, as gently as he could, said, well, this whole malady, this whole disease, is something still wrapped in a great deal of mystery. But we do know that the habit of drinking in some people becomes a compulsion, an obsession, and finally a veritable insanity, which condemns its victims to drink in spite of their will and against their best interest. And Lois, like many another wife, sharing this realization, said to the doctor, and doctor, what does this mean? How serious is this? And the gentle old man had to tell her, well, when he first came here, I thought he might be one of those rare few who could be re-educated out of his malady, who with a better understanding might get a fresh grip on life. But Mrs. Wilson, I fear that he is like nearly all the others who've come this way over the years. And like all of those others who have gone this same way over the centuries past, I fear now that his obsession is too deep, that it cannot be broken. And again Lois pleaded, but doctor, what does that mean? And you know what he had to say. He had to let her know that I would have to be locked up somewhere, unless soon I would go mad or die. So that was a realization that she shared with me, as many a wife has shared with her mate, time out of mind. And even in the days since AA. Now that realization of hopelessness, paradoxically enough, lies at the very root of our success, as you all know. What was the next realization of great moment? Well, it was the realization on the part of a friend who thought he had an answer that I might need his help. So a friend came to me, even as friends have since come to you, hoping that they could be helpful. This was an old schoolmate. I hadn't seen him for years. Since I had learned a good deal about this malady by then, I had long since tabbed him as a hopeless one, like me. Here he was in New York sober. He was on the telephone. I said, come over. We'll drink. Ebbie, we'll talk about the good old days. Ah, what great force there was in that unconscious observation. We'll talk about the good old days. Why would we talk about the good old days? Because for us the future was unbearable. The present was unbearable. There was no future. That's why we would live in the past. He and I. Over that crock of gin on my kitchen table. So soon, like many a friend has come since, he's looking across the table at me. Somehow I sensed that he was not just on the water wagon. Something had happened. He told me he didn't want a drink. I said, are you on the water wagon? He said, oh, no. I'm just not drinking. Oh, come, said I. What's got into you? And he looked at me and said, I've got religion. Well, for a lusty agnostic like me, that was a terrible disappointment. I felt horribly let down. I said, my God, my poor friend has got religious insanity. It takes the place of alcoholic insanity. Too bad. So I said, well, come now. Tell me what brand of religion is this? He said, why, I wouldn't call it religion exactly. Just common sense, nothing new about it. But for me, it did do the trick. I feel as though my obsession had been taken away from me. He said, I feel that I have been released. Strange statement for a man on the water wagon to make. No, this was something different. Well, I said, what's the formula? Tell me. And so then he gave me the elements, which today lie at the core of our procedure in AA. And he put them in very simple language. Old ancient principles, old as the hills. Said he, by contact with a certain group of people, I picked up these ideas. They emphasized them. Certainly there's nothing new. I got honest with myself about my own defects. I quit this living alone. I talked out my defects with another person. I made a confession. I made a list of the people I'd harmed and visited them and made what amends and restitution I could. And I learned about a new kind of giving, at least new to me, the kind of giving that demands no reward. I was told that I ought to try to help other people without any demand for prestige or material consideration. Now, he said, I know you're awful gun-shy on this religious stuff. He said, I'm not a guy with any theology or anything, but he said, I do believe in God. God as I understand him. And he said, in order to make this simple program work in my life, I found it necessary to pray to whatever God there was, as I understood him. Such was my friend's message to me. And such has this message in its essence been ever since. As simple as that. And yet, in the hands of another alcoholic, capable of penetrating and healing as those ancient verities never healed alcoholics before. The secret was, of course, that one alcoholic was talking to another. So what he said struck me deep. Indeed, he lived in my sense, had lived in my strange world, but now I saw that he had been taken out of that world. His sanity had been restored. Fortunately, he didn't try to evangelize me, or pressure me, or save my soul, as desirable as that could have been and probably would still be. He finally took his leave. Well, I went on drinking. In those days, I was on a bottle of gin a day to be teed up, and two and three a day when I got tight, which was pretty often. Lois was at work in her department store. I was pretty rough on the great Wall Street guy, she now being the provider. You guys here understand that, some of you. So I sat in that kitchen. I kept right on drinking several days. But in no waking out could the thought of my friend leave me. In no waking hour could I expel those principles from my mind he had advocated. And yet I rebelled at the God concept. How could one get that? But at length I came to the same conclusion you fellas have, and you gals who have been in this extremity. I said to myself, after all, who are beggars to be children? I am a doomed one. And if I had cancer, if carcinoma was my trouble, I would gladly place myself in charge of any physician there was who could exercise those hellish cells. And is not this thing, alcoholism, a cancer of the body, a cancer of the emotions? And yes, if there be such a thing, is it not a cancer of the soul? So if there be any great physician, you had better seek him out. So with that realization, I took the decision, as you have since, to go to the hospital and get dried up. Incidentally, being kind of a conservative damn Yankee, I didn't want to have any of this down south shot in religion, you know. So I went up to hospital. Like all other drunks on their way to be cured for the last time, I got tight as a tick and came in there waving a bottle, shouting at the doctor I had something. He said, "Well, I'm afraid you have, my boy. You better get upstairs and go to bed." So I went just upstairs and went to bed, and in 3 days I was all free of alcohol and sedation. See, I'd gone a month early before the DTs caught up with me. When suddenly one morning, a day I was feeling mighty low, in the door there stood my friend. Well, I hadn't seen him for years. I knew he was hard up. There he was, way uptown New York, early in the morning, seeing me. I thought, as you have since thought, this man practices what he preaches. Then I got a little scary to evangelize me, turn on that sweetness and light button. Oh, no, he's Cajun, just like we've learned to think. Said, "Just came up to pay you a visit, Bill. Heard you were up here. Hope I can be of a little help." But still, he didn't tell me what that formula was again, that prescription for recovery from alcoholism. He waited. He made me ask him. "What is it, Abby? How do you do this again?" "Oh, well, it's simple," said he. "You get honest with yourself. You talk it out with another in confidence. Make a confession, holding back nothing. You look around at the damage you've done other people and go and make restitution. You try to be helpful to other folks without any demand for a reward. And you pray to whatever God there is, and that's all there is to it, period." And he said, "If you can really come to the decision to try that, even though you got no faith, I think maybe it'll help you." It did me. So he talks about the weather and a few friends, and off he's gone again. Sounds very familiar. It's happened a lot of times since, hasn't it? One alcoholic talking to another. One alcoholic reaching us at depths that no other human being has ever been able to plumb. So there it was. Well, the rebellion went on, this God business. I began to get more and more depressed. I finally sunk into an utter blackness. I was a child, alone, hopeless, crying in the dark. And at last, in desperation, I said, "Well, now, just like a cancer patient, I will do anything to get well, anything to be rid of this fateful thing." And then I said, "If there is a God, will he show himself?" At once, it seemed to me, that room lighted up in a great, bright light. I was caught up into an ecstasy for which there is no description. The overwhelming thought came, "You're a free man." And in the mind's eye, it seemed as though I suddenly stood on a mountain, and around me is a great wind blowing. Not of air. A wind of God. The grace of God. And I knew I was a free man. I don't know how long I was in this singular state. At length it subsided. Of course, I still lie on the bed, just where I was. But now, seemingly, I am in a different world. And a great peace steals over me. I feel at one with the universe. And my first cogent thought was, so this is the God of the preacher. Thus came to me in a great flash, in a cataclysm, the realization that there was a God, that He was at hand, and that His grace could do for me what I could not do for myself. Well, that realization, which I then had, has since been shared with tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of us, if we include our families. And I hear some of you saying, well, I didn't have any hot flash like that guy Bill. I think he was a little mawkish at the time. Yes, you have. The identical thing has been given you, a gift of grace by which you were able to do that which you couldn't before. And in most cases, it has come to you in a week, in a month, in 3 months, in some cases, belatedly in several years. But has it not come, that indefinable something, that contact with that higher power, that once we make ready for Him, does for us what we cannot do for ourselves? So there was another cornerstone realization. And with this realization, I took the decision that any of you would have taken. I thought this is a matter, a thing of great power. These simple principles in the hands of one alcoholic talking to another. Utterly simple, yet with great and mysterious power. Why, all the drunks in the world should be able to get a thing like this. So I frantically rushed around working on drunks. And, of course, I made the usual mistake. Some of you made them. I thought they ought to have a hot flash just like mine. See them stars and things. They all tapped their heads and looked the other way. Said, mocking. Nothing happened. Nobody got well. And yet now, somehow, I felt and never lost the conviction that here was a clue, a key, which might unlock that dark secret of alcoholism. So I kept on working. Meanwhile, very sad to relate, my first friend fell by the wayside. He never did quite recover. God love him, he's just as much a founder of this movement as I. Incidentally, there are many founders of this movement. I wish we could abolish that word, founder. In fact, dear people, if you will leave with me the satisfaction of having been one of the early members of Alcoholics Anonymous, I will sell you the foundership for $1.98. Are there any takers? Well, at any rate, I frantically rush around trying to fix drunks for 6 months. And finally, my more practical relatives began to say, well, when in hell is this guy going to work and support Lois? How long is he going to be a missionary here? And egged on by them, I used to go over and sit in brokerage stops on those nice customer chairs they have in there and look at the ticker. And, you know, I used to be in Wall Street. So I made a shift at going back to work, but none of my old friends would have me, of course. They didn't have much confidence in that hot flash business. Of course, I was telling anybody, everybody in a loud voice about it. So one day, I'm sitting beside another stranger. And unwittingly, he played a part. He became a link in that chain of destiny that began to stretch out from those hours. And I fell into a business deal, and the business deal led me to Akron, and it was struggle for control of a little company there. And there was a proxy row, and it looked like we had control, these new associates that I had suddenly picked up. And the other side had more votes, and so my side went home and left me flat broke in the Mayflower Hotel, kind of a fly-by-night job. Well, I had counted on this new opportunity. It might have made me president of a small concern in a new town, and I thought, well, again, we'll hold our heads up, we'll get Lois out of that goddamn department store, and And life will look up, and of course, in my spare time, I'll work with drums. But no, destiny, let us say Providence, perhaps had other ideas. So my effort to go back into business failed. And walking up and down in the lobby of the Mayflower Hotel at Akron, I suddenly panicked. In all those ways of self-pity and anger, and I was mad because I thought some of those proxies were forged, which had defeated me. All of a sudden, I'm in a fright of getting drunk. Well, I couldn't pray it away. I couldn't wish it away. There it was. I began to look in the bar. It was a Saturday afternoon. The folks in there were filling up, you know, and the buzz was getting better and more interesting. I walked to the other end of the lobby. There I saw a church directory. At random, I called up a preacher. I told him I was a drunk from New York who needed another drunk to work on. And that's the first time that I probably ever used those words. Up to this point, I've been preaching from this fine spiritual and moral hilltop on which I thought I'd been divinely set. But this time, I realized I needed another drunk just as much as he needed me. I needed him to keep me sober. So another deep realization, a new one, showed up. And a good many of you know how that quest led me face to face with dear old Dr. Bob, who passed out of our sight and hearing last November, but who is right here tonight, in my belief. Well, when I set eyes on that drunk, I told him right away I needed him as much as he needed me. Gone was the preaching. Gone was this divine appointment to fix all the drunks in the world. Now I'm busy on how am I going to stay sober. So we talked for hours. And we were brought together by a non-alcoholic who, out of a long list of people who turned the other way, found time and cared enough to bring us together, even as my doctor had cared enough. Non-alcoholics have played critical parts in the destiny of our society. Well, the outgrowth of the talk was that Bob's wife, dear Annie Smith, invited me to come to live at their house for a few weeks to see if I could revive my business venture. She had a more practical reason. I could keep an eye on that husband of hers. He could keep one on me. We worked there long before Smithy said, well, what about working with some drunks? Hadn't we better be getting busy, if only in self-protection? And I said, you bet your boots. So he calls up the city hospital, where he had been ousted from the staff, knew the head nurse down in the receiving ward, told her over the phone that the guy had come along from New York, and between he and me, we had a cure for alcoholism. Bob blushed at that point. The nurse had said, well, doctor, you'd better try it yourself. Well, she said, we got a dandy prospect for you. Just come in here. Used to be a good lawyer around town, formerly a member of the city council. Hasn't been dry for years. Getting in awful shape. Can't even go home from here without getting drunk. I'm sure he wants to stop, but somehow he can't. He's got the DTs now. He just knocked down one of the nurses and blacked her eyes, and we got him strapped. How would that case do you? Bob said that sounds very promising. Let's put him to bed, and we'll be down when you get him cleared up, and here's what you want to give him. So, a little later, Dr. Bob and I saw a sight which thousands of you have since seen, and God willing, hundreds of thousands of us shall still see. The sight of the man on the bed who doesn't know that he can get well. The man on the bed, however, was a skeptic, as many have since been. The man on the bed said, well, it's too late for me. You fellas have been through the ringer. But you were only in up to your knees, up to your waist. I'm in up to my neck. It's too late. It's too late. I'm worse than that. I don't even dare go out of here. I'll be drunk before I get home, and somehow I don't want to be, but I will. And he said, old religion, don't talk to me about that. He said, I am already a man of faith. I still got faith in God, strangely enough. But God has got no faith in me. I don't know what's got a hold of me. It's too late. We said, can we come tomorrow? Yes, he said, I'd like to talk with you. He said, it's wonderful to talk with someone who understands. So on tomorrow we came, and Dr. Bob saw the sight that you have since beheld. The man on the bed looked up as we came in and said to his wife, why, there they are. They are the ones who understand. And she had been saying to him, why, what's got into you? My husband, you seem so different. He said, this is the reason. They understand. They have been through the mill. They are the alcoholics I was telling you about. And then excitedly he related how during the night hope had come to him. And after that, something more than hope. Because the moment that he decided to try our simple formula, something began to happen. He felt lighter. He felt a sense of release. A weight had taken off of his chest. He began strangely to feel all in one piece again. His confidence began to grow that if Dr. Bob and I could find this answer, so might he. And by now he was bursting full of confidence, this hopeless one of the day before, and he said to his wife, my dear, please fetch my clothes. We are going to get up and get out of here. And A. number 3 rose from his bed and went out from there, never to drink again. And that was the summer of 1935. Though we realize it not, the first group had taken shape. The promise of the good book started to be literally fulfilled. Two or three of us were gathered together. Well, that summer we went on working with drunks. Returning now to New York with the more becoming humility, I got another one started out there. I made a shift to return to business, but again it blew up in my face. So by the fall of 1937, 3 years later, I came west looking for something to do. Meanwhile, of course, having contacted Bob a great deal. Meanwhile, having worked upon hundreds of alcoholics, and he had done likewise. There was failure upon failure upon failure. But a few of the children of the dark seemingly had turned their faces to the light. So in Akron and New York, there were small groups, and there was a little bit of a beginning in Cleveland, and a little indication in Washington and Philadelphia, perhaps. So at length, Dr. Bob and I come together again. It is now the fall of 1937. And in his living room, which to me is a hallowed place, today, he and I shared a realization. One of the greatest hours of realization that I've ever known, excepting that of my spiritual experience. We had been talking over the results, how many of the failures, how many of the successes. And finally we made a list of those who had stayed dry any length of time. And suddenly it burst upon us. Enough time has now elapsed on enough cases so that something new has happened. Something wonderful has begun to happen. Something can now be spread chain style, alcoholic talking to alcoholic. Ah, yes. We could clearly see the new light that for 3 years had been falling upon us children of the night. Now the light was plain for anyone to see. And here were the recoveries. Oh, I don't know, maybe 40 of us. So, with this realization, we are saddled with an immense responsibility. How is this message going to be transmitted to the million who don't know? Even to the hundreds right here in Akron. It's taken us 3 years of hard work to produce these two little groups. How shall we spread the message? Dare we allow it to go just by word of mouth? Dare we remain in this halcyon simplicity of the front parlor and coffee and cakes? Now, hospitals don't want us. Shouldn't we have a chain of hospitals? And at that time, we suppose nothing but the old master barbers, you know, could put on this shave, so shouldn't some of the old-timers be subsidized, kind of temporary missionaries to go out to, you know, Chicago and L.A. and Kansas City, and Dallas probably, drunks there. You know, subsidized few missionaries. But above all, shouldn't we have a book? Shouldn't we put it on the record what had happened to us and how this thing worked? Didn't we owe at least that much to these million drunks right here in America who did not know? Well, of course, that involved a radical step. So Dr. Bob called the little Akron group together. I remember that meeting in the late fall of 37 as though it were yesterday. I can see the faces there in that living room. And, of course, by this time I had become wildly excited. I'm a promoter by nature, a salesman. I'd already begun to dream about the greatest religious and social and medical development of all time, and I was flailing my arms around it. When I began to talk about books and missionaries and hospital chains and finance drunk tanks, I could see their faces fall. And as the discussion went on, that meeting divided into three parts. Three characteristic parts. The same parts that this movement has divided into over the question of whether we should go on with this general service idea. And the conservative or orthodox section said, let's keep AA simple. We pass this word on mouth to mouth. No money, no obligation. That's why it works. If you go into the hospital business, you'll be ruined. If you subsidize missionaries to carry this out, you'll create a professional class. It'll ruin us. It'll spoil it. Don't do it. Then said they, well, even if you get a book, we're going to quarrel over who's going to write the damn book. Will it be any good? And who's going to make the money out of this book? Even a book will spoil this. Don't do any of these things, said the conservative Orthodox people. Well, those folks weren't entirely wrong. But, thank God, they weren't entirely right either. Then we had another section in that little meeting. They were the indifferent people. They said, oh, well, if Bill and Doc want to raise money and have missionaries and books, all right with us, but don't bother us. We're all right, we don't. Then there were the promoter guys like me who said, look, if you don't do these things, this thing will fall right apart. In other words, if you don't have at least a book, your public relations will get garbled, we'll bust up into 100 different cults, and worst of all, we will not bring it in front of those million alcoholics. What has happened to us? My God, they aren't all going to come to Akron to get well. Are you going to wait years while this travels around by word of mouth? No, we got to have a book. And in the back of my head, I was still thinking about financing a string of them drunk tanks, too. And I kind of wanted to be a missionary myself. You know, the Wilsons were kind of hard up. Lois was still in that damn department store. Well, the upshot of it was that the promotion element in the meeting, which was me and two or three others, Smithy kind of in the middle, he's conservative, the promotion fellas plus the indifferent fellas created enough votes so the meeting decided, well, now, Bill, if you think this all important, we get a lot of dough, you go back to New York City, where there's a lot of dough, and you get it up, see? Get these drunk tanks and missionaries and that book. Well, by this time, I was just as high in a kite. You know, drunks can get intoxicated on other things than gin. And I was just intoxicated with this idea. I got it all ballooned up. And I figured I was a good salesman, you know, and I primed, a few $100,000 just for a starter out of the rich. It just looked like no nothing at all. My God, here with alcoholism, the hopeless, hopeless disease, gentlemen. And now look at these cures, 40 of them, 40 of them. Hey. Well, I began to solicit the very rich on my acquaintance. And then I made a very disheartening discovery. I discovered that the very rich had no interest in drunks. That is, at least of investing money in drunks. They probably had all had a bad experience. So then I went to the Rockefeller Foundation. Well, I figured this is, you know, has social implications, medical implications, religious implications. It'll be right up old John D.'s alley. John D. will like this because it's got that alcohol angle in it. Well, at the Rockefeller Foundation, right after that break in the market in 1937, they felt kind of hard up there. They were kind of short of money at the time. Besides, this didn't fit any particular category. It wasn't exactly medical, religious, social, or what have you. Something like that fellow used to run around at the tail end of Barnum and Bailey's circus. They used to call him Zip. What is it? You'll probably remember him. Well, AA was something like that. In fact, we didn't even have a name. They used to ask me what this was, and I used to call it a bunch of drunks trying to get along. So I'm pretty discouraged. When I get discouraged, you know, I'm one of them psychosomatic guys, I get imaginary ulcers. So I had a bad attack of imaginary ulcers. And one of my brother-in-law, he's a doctor, see what to do about the imaginary ulcers. I get bellyaching to him about how stingy the rich are on account of these drunks. Got to get money, else it's going to fall all apart. Says he, why don't you talk to Shirley Wynn, the health commissioner? He shares an office with me, so I go in and tell the story to Shirley Wynn. He said, the guy for you to see is John D. Rockefeller personally. Oh, I said, Dr. Wynn, what about an introduction to the Prince of Wales? I mean, he could probably help out on this if I could only get to him. How do I get introduced to John D.? Then comes one of those strange events. My brother-in-law said, well, when I went to school, I used to know a gal. She had an uncle. Maybe he's dead. I think he was a member of the Rockefeller entourage, great friend of the family, somehow mixed up with their charities. His name was Richardson. Maybe he's alive. I'll call up Mr. Rockefeller's offices and see what about it. So he called up, and this old man comes on the wire. In jig time, within an hour, we were right in Mr. John D. Rockefeller's private personal offices talking to one of his best friends. Now, figure that one out. So I figured, well, we're getting hot now. This thing's really getting warm. I mean, we're getting near that big dog. And the old gentleman asked me to have lunch with him, and shortly after that, we have a meeting with a lot of Mr. Rockefeller's friends, and they listen to all these drunk stories, and they're all head up about it. One of them even comes out to Akron, makes an investigation, comes back to New York City, and says, well, this is really it. We'd steered him in the direction of Akron because Smithy was harder up then. They were just going to pull the pucker string on the mortgage on his house. Gee, things look good. The guy came back with a report. Well, I'll start this off with $50,000, you know, just a starter, Mr. Rockefeller's money, and we need the drunk tank in Akron. We'll put Smithy in there. He's a doctor, and of course, we'll get a little subsidy for a few of these guys and a little money for the book, and of course, this will be just a starter, $50,000 project just to kick things off. Well, then came another great... the realization and decision. You see, at that time, I had got all the drunks sold that we just needed a hell of a lot of money to make this thing go and to spread it. Naturally, we thought in business terms, and naturally, I thought in terms of eating, too. You know, I was hungry. A lot of AAs have had them temptations before or since. Well, we, soon heard that Mr. Richardson was taking this report to Mr. Rockefeller, his old friend Junior, as he called him. So he lays the report on Junior's desk, and Junior reads it. Pretty soon he's talking to his old friend Dick. Mr. Rockefeller shakes his head and he said, somehow, Dick, I'm very strangely affected by this moving account. This thing is small, but it might have very great possibilities. Because, Dick, this is pure first-century Christianity. Dick, I'm terribly afraid that if we give this thing any money, we'll kill it. Ordinarily, yes. Sure, it affects me very deeply. Alcohol, medicine, all these fields I'm interested in, but Dick, I'm afraid. I'm afraid we'll spoil it, said John D. Rockefeller, if we give it money. And so that man took a decision that he would not give us money, even though he was already deeply interested and we had engaged the interest of some of his closest friends. In other words, he took a decision, I am sure, under the guidance of God, which has deeply affected our destiny. Well, boy, when the bad news came out, it was tough, I'm telling you. Mr. Rockefeller did put a few dollars only in the Riverside Church treasury, and for a few months they were doled out to Smithy and me, and the heat was taken off that house, mortgage on Smith's house. And that's all that happened. No books, no missionaries, no hospitals, no nothing. Well, we drunks persisted with these new friends. We opined that Mr. Rockefeller might be mistaken. And how could we just sit and pass this on? At least we needed a book. We needed some money. Well, his friends agreed with us. So somebody said, why don't we form a foundation, kind of like the Rockefeller Foundation? We'll give you boys a list of names that you can solicit for some dough, and you get the money in here, and the rich can put it in tax-free, and we'll have money with which to do this book, and at least finance a few of them. So, with a great deal of to-do, with the free services of one of the biggest law firms in New York, a charter was drawn up for something that you have since heard of, called the Alcoholic Foundation. Sounds very imposing, but was nothing but an incorporated committee of some of these friends and two or three of us drunk. I stayed off, as you see, because I figured I'd be one of the beneficiaries. Well, anyway, we began to have meetings of this foundation, and we were, sure enough, supplied with credentials by which to pry some money out of the very rich. So all during the summer of 1938, we salesmen in New York went after these rich alcoholics with the backing of Mr. John D. Rockefeller's friends. Now figure that one out. Any promoter in this audience would say that ought to be plenty good enough, at least for a few bucks. And believe it or not, people, we worked all summer to raise money for that foundation, and we didn't get one damn cent. Praise God. Well, it was pretty discouraging. The rich were either going to Florida or maybe Texas, I don't know. They thought the TB was a better cause. They said to us, well, why scrape up the last miserable dregs of society? The rich had no interest in drunks, period, that was for sure. And how fortunate it was. Had we got in money in that period, this society as we know it today would never exist. Therefore, that decision of Mr. Rockefeller's not to give us money saved this society. And later, as you will see, he gave very greatly of himself, not of his money. Well, by this time, our big ideas are whittled down to the size where we figured we just had to have a book, though. I mean, we had to put this thing on the record. So, there wasn't any money in the foundation to feed me while a book was being done and hire a gal and so on. At that time, now the midsummer of 38, we'd got testimonials from Johns Hopkins, and we had a couple of chapters of this book attached to the prospectus for the rich. At a foundation meeting, which was one of those commiseration gatherings with these new friends, one of them said, well, Bill, why don't you take this book down to Harper's? I know the religious editor. To my great surprise, Harper's bid on it. They said, sure, we'll give you $1,500 advance royalty, Mr. Wilson. Gee, I was flabbergasted. That sounded like about $15,000 to me. We were really hard up and Lois working that department store stuff. And then it came to us, the alcoholics. We couldn't give this book to a publisher if it amounted to anything. This movement should own that book. We should publish this book ourselves. Well, we went back to the hard-headed business friends up at Rockefeller Center, and they said, why, amateurs never publish books and get away with it. You can't do that. Well, we said, after all, gentlemen, that there isn't any money in the foundation to do it. I used to say that quite pointedly about then. Why don't we get up a subscription among the drunks and see if we can't do it? And against their unanimous advice to the contrary, we went and did just that. In other words, decision number one, that it saved this thing from professionalism and great money and wealth and property ownership, was made by Mr. Rockefeller and his friends. The decision that this fellowship should publish and own this book and control it, also a very vital thing, as you shall see, was made by us drunks over their objection, thereby giving you just a little fragment of our history, where time after time, events and people have intervened constantly to turn this thing from the left-hand path always into the right. Well, the fantastic story of how we sold $4,500 worth of stock to all the drunks around New York in a book that hadn't yet been written, and how the sheriff almost got the book, and how finally Mr. Rockefeller, 3 years later, gave us a dinner and told the world that this thing was good. All of those things I told you last night. But we did come up with the book Alcoholics Anonymous, which today is owned by this same board of trustees and held in trust for you, the members of AA. The income from it is all yours. It goes to the foundation of the group, accepting a royalty on that book, which I receive for authorship, which is the only money I receive out of any AA source, which I earned, I think, as an author and not as a missionary. In fact, you drunk sitting down there, I have got you for 50 cents every time we sell one of those books. How do you like it? Well, how we got through those years, I don't know. Somebody felt kind of sorry for me the other night and said, it must have been terrible, Bill. I said, no, it was wonderful. Those for me were the wonderful years of AA, the years of struggle, the years of flying blind when we were never quite blind, when we still had faith. The years in which the fundamental principles were hammered out and applied. Those were the great years of AA. Why? Because we could see that people had begun to get well, that the chain reaction was starting that might one day spread over the world. That's what kept all of us going then. What was a little problem? What were a few difficulties in the face of a spectacle of God's bringing something new into the world, especially into that dark world we knew so well? Well, you all know how in the year 1941, Jack Alexander published that piece in the Post, which brought thousands of frantic inquiries to our little office in New York. Right then and there, AA entered a new phase. And incidentally, the decision about that was not taken by alcoholics, it was taken by a non-alcoholic, just one. And I only recently heard the complete story. We had some AAs in Philadelphia with Saturday Post connections, and they suggested a piece, and the Post had always turned it away. And finally, to our great and sudden surprise, Jack Alexander was assigned to do that piece. Star writer for the Post. Gee, are we excited. What had happened? And as you know, that piece spelled out recovery for thousands of us. To some of us, it meant even life itself. And let's see what a slender thread that decision hung and who made it. It appeared that one day the editorial staff was discussing us, whether this was a sect or a cult or something phony, whether it was a racket, whether it did what was claimed. And some of them thought it was one thing and thought it was another. And they were quite undecided as to whether they dared publish anything about us, although Liberty had already published us, and John Dee had held this dinner for us in which he had published to the world that he believed in it. Yet the Post was still suspicious and doubtful. And they were having this editorial discussion. Should they publish anything about this new society? Which then, incidentally, had run up from 100 members in 1939 up to almost 2,000 by that time, under the impetus of the Liberty Piece and Mr. Rockefeller's interest in us. Should they do it? Well, I have only recently been told that the owner of the Saturday Post happened to be present at that meeting. And he listened to this discussion for a long time, and he said, "Well, gentlemen, I rarely hate to interfere with editorial decisions on this magazine. But I must speak up and tell you that I personally know two of these recovered people. And, gentlemen, it is a miracle. It is miraculous. I think the Post should publish this piece." On that slender... How many lives hung? Only God knows. Ah, yes, AA has been a long succession of great realizations and great decisions. Well, with the advent of the Saturday Post piece, we were confronted with an entirely new problem. The problem now was, could these new groups hang together? We found the individual, he could hang together, he could get well. But could these crazy drunks hang together in groups? We found that even sobered up...